Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and practiced on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. High Truths is more than a podcast. It's a movement to unite physical, mental, and addiction health. It brings innovations to connect public health, public safety, and prevention. Our discussions inspire people to implement programs that save lives. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a 5-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com. Today's episode is sponsored by Drug Free America Foundation, tackling the pervasive issue of substance use and its far-reaching impacts on individuals, families, and community. Drug Free America is supporting ISAC, the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis, doctors and scientists educating on the harms of marijuana. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for a reorganization conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. Reorganization, as in the Trump administration's changes to the Health and Human Services Agency by Secretary Robert Kennedy Jr. RFK campaigned on his promise to end the chronic disease epidemic and make America healthy again, MAHA. Who can be against that? Who can be against getting rid of dyes and unnecessary chemicals in our food supply? But I know there is much fear and confusion and anxiety from the medical community and patients about basic healthcare and access. I get it. Change is difficult in any organization and situation. There's a complete reorganization proposal of the Health and Human Services Department. What's to remain? What's to be dozed? What happens to SAMHSA, CDC, NIDA, FDA, and key agencies that are important to the prevention, treatment, and recovery of drugs? What about payment for addiction services and medical care? How does all that affect the average American or organization that deals with drug issues? To learn more about the reorganization of HHS, I reached out to Jeffrey Davis. Jeffrey Davis is a skilled healthcare executive with substantial knowledge of regulatory advocacy and healthcare policies. I recently read an article he wrote about the changes within HHS, Health and Human Services, and seized the opportunity to reconnect with him and invite him to High Truths. To learn more about Jeffrey Davis, check out the High Truths show notes. I recorded this conversation with Jeff on June 27, 2025. Jeff Davis, welcome to High Truths.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm very excited to connect again from the days of the emergency department. And now you're still working in healthcare. And I saw that you really advising people on what all the changes are. People are change is hard for a lot of people, but to really understand what's happening, and you help explain that to other people. And I wanted you to share that with my listeners.
Yeah, happy to be here. Yeah, I work for a consulting firm now, but still work a lot of emergency medicine issues and other issues as well. But a lot of health systems, a lot of other stakeholders in the healthcare community really want to understand what's happening in the healthcare world right now with some of the changes that are being contemplated for the Department of Health and Human Services. So really happy to explain what's happening or what we think is going to happen to the audience here today.
And you'll explain that if it's still a moving target. But start with your journey. How did you get your expertise in health policy?
Sure. So I went to school for public health at the Harvard School of Public Health, Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. And after that, I worked for the federal government for about 8 years. I was a presidential management fellow, worked at the Department of Health and Human Services, HHS, in the budget office for 8 years. In the budget office, it gave me a very good perspective, a high-level view of all the policymaking, the budget-making process, how the sausage is made, so to speak, at HHS, how regulations are cleared and get out the door, how new models from CMS Innovation Center goes out and gets cleared and gets out the door. So it really gave me a great perspective on how the government works and operates. I came to HHS right after the Affordable Care Act had passed. And I like to say, people have been working on the Medicare and Medicaid programs for decades. And I can't, as a newbie, I couldn't compete with that. But everybody, when major legislation like the Affordable Care Act was passed, or like the Medicare and CHIP Reauthorization Act, the MACRA was passed, that those big pieces of legislation really kind of create level playing fields for people coming into the federal government, really understanding how there's a new major piece of legislation, how is that implemented, what new regulations have to go out the door. And so that would really being there for about an 8-year period between 2010 and 2018 with big pieces of legislation gave me a really good opportunity to really understand, again, what how HHS works as a big department, and we can discuss that about the changes that are being contemplated and what the department looks like now, but really how the department operates, and also kind of how policy and the policy making process is done. After that, where we crossed paths is I was the director of regulatory affairs of the American College of Emergency Physicians, ASAP, and in that capacity, you know, while HHS. It was great understanding how the sausage is made, so to speak, but I wanted to understand what the implications of those policies were to physicians, to patients, what they cared about with the rules, what they really understood about the regulatory process. And it was a really good opportunity to work outside the federal government, so starting in the federal government, then working outside the federal government, to really understand what those issues were. And at that time, I started a blog called Regs and Eggs, which I still continue to this point, really trying to understand what are the major regulations impacting patients, impacting physicians, impacting the healthcare community. And I started that blog because I really wanted to explain exactly why regulations were important, why physicians should understand their implications. I've been at McDermott Plus for about 2 years. It's a DC-based consulting firm. We still work with in the emergency medicine space. And also a lot of other healthcare issues and clients across the board and for both health systems and other types of stakeholders within the healthcare community, really helping them navigate both on the legislative front and the regulatory front, what's happening here. We do data analytics as well. We also do some market access work. But I still work a lot in the regulatory space. I still write that Regs and Eggs blog. And to that end,
firm? Do you lobby?
We do lobby. Yes, we do lobby. So we do regulatory work, advocacy work, and lobbying. And we do a lot of data analysis, too. And then the third thing we do is called market access work. We help bring new devices, new drugs on the market through coverage determinations, reimbursement work, working with getting new codes from the CPT or the RUC processes. So working, doing a lot of work on that as well. And new coverage determinations through the national coverage determination and local coverage determination processes. So do a lot of work in that space as well. But I still am the regulatory person. So do a lot of my hands are still in that regulatory space. So doing a lot of work with the administration, trying to figure out, again, both in Medicare, Medicaid, and other spaces as well, what the regulatory landscape looks like, what changes could be made, and how those changes are going to be made as well. So
do you advise the government also, or private?
No, to private entities in terms of how they can approach the federal government, make their voices heard. And there's a lot of opportunities to advocate and to, as a physician or a hospital system or other types of system, by commenting on regulations. This administration and the beginning of the administration has had a lot of requests for information on deregulation efforts, how to deregulate, how to get rid of unnecessary regulations that really impede patient care. So helping our clients think about what are those barriers, what are those regulatory burdens that would be that this administration is very, you know, really looking for to be able to modify or eliminate, to really take away some of those requirements that impede the ability to provide patient care in a seamless way. So they've been in information gathering phase right now. We've been advising our clients about how to make their voices heard and get that information to the department in terms of that deregulation initiative.
Wow. I don't know if I want to jump right into that, but I do want to ask you about that, about what would be important in the drug addiction space for that. But let's go back and say, what are the changes? There's some changes going on. I think a lot of good. I mean, like, who wants, you know, dyes in their food and chemicals? But there's also structural changes. The whole department is changes. So people get uncomfortable with change. But what are the changes?
Yeah. So I'll explain the changes at a high level, and we can go into depth in terms of the new changes. So the Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. came in the department and really did an analysis of overall what does the department look like, what are the parts of the department, and how you can streamline functions. So just give you an overall picture of how the department works how it has worked in the past. There are two overarching types of entities within the Department of Health and Human Services, what they're called operating divisions, which are big agencies like the CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Administration, SAMHSA, which we'll talk about, and other big agencies that actually run day-to-day programs. They put out regulations, they put out grants. These are the big parts of HHS that actually operate different programs.
There are also things,
FDA too, exactly, yes. There are a bunch of them as well. I didn't list them all, but there are a bunch of them. And then there are called, other entities called staff divisions, which are housed within the Office of the Secretary. And they don't run programs themselves, but are really entities that really provide advice to the secretary on different matters. I worked in one of them, the budget office. Another one was Assistant Secretary for Planning and Evaluation, or ASPE. This is another one of them that provides like research and analysis, but they don't run day-to-day programs. It's really the operating divisions that run programs. Overall, when Secretary Kennedy came in, there were about 82,000 people that worked at HHS. And his major argument, and he said this multiple times in hearings, and when asked about this, is that, again, 82,000 people, and that has grown significantly over the last 5, 10 years. And while that growth has taken place, Secretary Kennedy stated that overall outcomes have not improved. In fact, Secretary Kennedy states that the outcomes and patient outcomes and life expectancy and all the factors that the in terms of health that they're monitoring have declined. So the department has grown, but it's not necessarily led to better health outcomes. So he's taken a look and tried to streamline functions. Now, what he's done is he's tried to reduce the number of staff. So again, I mentioned 82,000 people when he came in. About 10,000 of them left when they were offered different fork in the road options. If you've heard of that, I know some folks have heard of that, where they get an option of retirement or other opportunities to leave the federal government. There was also a reduction of probationary staff who had been there for 1 or 2 years, who had not reached that permanent status. So about 10,000 people left that way. And then he instituted a RIF, about 10,000 people on April 1st. So that got down from 82,000 to 62,000. So 10,000 initially, and then 10,000 with additional RIF. That 10,000 people haven't actually left the agency department yet, because of court cases, because of other snags in the road. A lot of them are starting administrative leave, and some of them have been actually hired back. The secretary has been very vocal about, you know, if he found that mistakes had been made, or if a firing left a critical gap, he would hire those folks back. So they're in the, even though the 10,000 were fired on April 1st, that number is fluctuating, again, because of legal issues, because they've been hiring people back. People have been hired back throughout this last few months. So it's the actual numbers of reduction are still a little bit in flux. Besides the reduction in staff, he also wanted to restructure the department as well. And this gets into a little bit into, you know, what's actually happening versus what he wants to happen and what they want the department to look like. And again, it's a little bit in flux, and I'll explain that in a minute. But what each of the operating divisions and the staff divisions, they, even though they are part of HHS, some of them have independent functions. And what he found is a lot of them have independent administrative functions and other types of functions that really you could have one of them across all of them, not one individually for involved in each one of them. So a lot of the IT, a lot of the admin, he wanted to be able to synthesize that. Also across different operating divisions, a lot of agencies had offices of minority health or similar offices doing different types of activities. And what he wanted to do was streamline all those activities into one overarching kind of entity. So instead of having administrative functions across all different agencies or the same types of offices doing similar types of work across all agencies, he really wanted to streamline that. So he proposed a major restructuring. The biggest change he wants to make, and I'll explain the other changes as well, but create a new administration for a healthy America, or AHA, AHA, or AHA, that would combine parts of CDC, but also combine some two major operating divisions, SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Administration, and HRSA, the Health Resources and Services Administration, HRSA and SAMHSA, into one overall arching administration for Healthy America.
Uh-huh. So does that mean that they won't be called SAMHSA or HRSA? They'll be called AHA?
Yes. And the question is, Dr. Lev, is whether or not they actually proposed that change to Congress. And Congress, again, appropriates. Right now, they give money to HRSA, to SAMHSA individually. So in order to give money to the AHA instead of HRSA and SAMHSA, Congress would theoretically need to approve this new AHA. And in their budget documents that they have just released for fiscal year 2026, HHS has requested, they've said, I want to work with Congress to create AHA, to be able to streamline these, eliminate HRSA and SAMHSA and move those functions into AHA. And the question is, what happens if Congress does not go along with that? What happens if Congress says, no, we don't want to create AHA. We want to continue funding HRSA, continue funding SAMHSA separately. That's the question of the hour. And if I have the answers to that question, I would be very much.
You'd get a pay raise.
Pay raise, exactly. But the thinking is they did request. It was a request to Congress to create AHA. And they do say very specifically in their budget justification documents, when they're making this request to Congress, that we want to work with Congress to create AHA. That being said, though, they do want to move forward with this. This is a big initiative for the secretary. So if Congress doesn't play along, they could explore other options. Now, I will mention, Dr. Lev, that right now they're unable to talk about those options because they are actually, and they've made this very public, they are being sued on this restructuring.
They're being sued about this?
Yes, and about the RIFs as well. So during congressional hearings, and there was actually one on June 24th, where he said, unfortunately, I cannot talk a lot about the restructuring because of the legal constraints about what the future plans are, because we're under obligation from the court not to be able to talk about it in detail. All we know really what their plans are, therefore, is what the budget documents suggest they want to do. The budget can say whatever they want to say. The budget is a blueprint for what the administration wants to put out. Every year they put out a president's budget, which is a really good indication. I worked on 8 of them, so I can say this. A really good indication of where the administration wants to go. Not necessarily where they will go, where Congress will approve, but where they want to go. It's a blueprint. And in that blueprint, they spell out exactly what programs they want to shift over to AHA and to other, and I'll explain other changes they want to make as well. But they also explain what programs they want to eliminate from and think are redundant. They want to, again, reduce unnecessary programs, reduce fraud, waste, and abuse. And they have a list of all these ideas in the budget documents. And there are hundreds of pages of budget of documents out there that are publicly available. If you Google FY 2026 President's Budget for HHS, you will get a lot of the documents and be able to look through what their plans are for the restructuring, for what they want funding levels to be for different programs within HHS. Again, it's a proposal, it's a President's Budget request that they want to work with Congress on. And so, unfortunately, Dr. Lev, right now we have a lot of what they want to do, and it's a little bit because of these lawsuits, because of, again, with the reduction in staff, they're hiring people back. A lot of them are still on administrative leave and haven't actually left the federal government yet. We're still a little bit of a flux period where we don't know exactly what the final outcome is going to look like once we figure out what Congress is going to do, when we figure out how the lawsuits will play out. And so, again, we know where they want to go, but have a little bit up in the air in terms of where they are now.
All right. Big details for things that affect the issue of drugs and addiction. So, for example, CDC, SAMHSA, FDA, NIDA, is that all what's happening in those agencies?
So a few of those agencies, like the FDA, for example, they proposed some modifications in the budget But the FDA is not overarchingly part of this restructuring. The biggest part of the restructuring is SAMHSA. SAMHSA is going to be integrated on all the behavioral health initiatives, are going to be integrated into AHA, this new Administration for Healthy America. So, you know, again, in terms of what that will look like, it's a little bit unclear, right? They're going to really still have a lot of the core programs from SAMHSA, but under an umbrella of the AHA administration, because they think that overarchingly, these mental health initiatives and others, primary care and other at HRSA programs within some programs within CDC and NIH really fit into this overall umbrella of making America healthy again. They're going to, as part of AHA, they're going to also have the Making America Healthy Again Commission, which has already released a report. And so it's all going to be under, everything can be kind of listed and as, again, under the MAHA movement will be in the Mission for Healthy America. And that does include mental health initiatives. Now, they do think, you know, once they shift over from SAMHSA, what's currently SAMHSA, to the AHA, one thing that I'm really looking forward to seeing is what the new structure of AHA will look like. Where near where the structures of SAMHSA were, where there be different types of approaches in terms of who would be in charge of different part functions within AHA that deal with mental health and how that all would be arranged. That's still a little bit up in the air. Where are the people who worked at SAMHSA going to actually be sitting and working every day? All those operational questions as well are still a little bit up in the air. But one thing for certain is that those important programs that were at SAMHSA will still be alive and ongoing, just under a different umbrella, a different organization, again, for streamlining purposes and to make sure that everything, that there aren't duplicative functions across the federal government, across HHS. And that's just really his vision.
And the goal for AHA, is it physical health and medical health kind of in that? And
Yes. Because by integrating SAMHSA and HRSA, so HRSA really does the primary care, SAMHSA does the mental health care into one space. You really, Dr. Lev, you hit the nail on the head, getting the physical health and the mental health under one umbrella, again, in the name of MAHA, of Making America Healthy Again.
And the parts of CDC, like they have their injury prevention.
Yes.
Group.
Injury prevention.
Also a lot of relate to medical health. They put that all together.
Yes. And the biggest,
that makes sense. That
and the biggest thing is the chronic diseases as well. The chronic disease programs, the birth defects and other types of developmental diseases, all those parts of this, the CDC, they're going to be also integrated into AHA as well. So parts of, even though CDC is still going to be operating as its own independent agency, parts of CDC are going to be integrated into the new Mission for Healthy America.
Okay, Jeff, you're giving us a great explanation. I think I'm starting to get it. The concept is to put kind of prevention, chronic disease, primary care, mental health, and put it all together in one agency, the AHA, Administration for a Healthy America. But what happens? Can you tell us a little bit specifically for issues related to addiction? How does that fall?
I'm happy to. So those programs around addiction, around mental health treatment, and what were in SAMHSA, and a lot of them are going to continue on in the Mission for Healthy America. Again, perhaps in the same structure as they were before at SAMHSA, but with appropriate streamlining and appropriate modifications. Perhaps a different structure because they're in a new agency, but those core programs will continue. Now, I will say, Dr. Lev, that in their budget justification for AHA, they do have a list of programs that they believe are duplicative or unnecessary from the different departments, and they list them. There are a bunch of them that they list from every single part of from HRSA, from SAMHSA, from different agencies that they want to eliminate, that they think should be eliminated. So not every program would transfer over to AHA because there are programs that they think should be eliminated. Again, they're asking Congress and for the approval for the elimination. In some respects, they can perhaps do some eliminations on their own, depending on what Congress does. But the major programs on addiction, major on mental health, will transfer over, similar to how they're structured now, but all transfer over to AHA.
What are any specific cuts that you see?
So yeah, there actually, if you go to the justification, there are a bunch of programs, about 15 to 20 programs in the mental health space that they would like to cut. Again, these programs they believe are no longer necessary or maybe do not align with the administration priorities.
Can you read us a few of them just so we can
Sure, I can.
This is from this 400-page document that I don't think most people are going to go through.
Exactly. Yes. I would read through them now. So in the mental health space.
And is mental health and addiction considered together as far as?
Yes. Okay. So they're eliminating, I'll just read you a few. Mental health awareness training. Mental health awareness training program, a mental health crisis response partnership pilot program, homelessness prevention programs, criminal and juvenile justice programs, minority AIDS innovation initiative for mental health, minority fellowship, seclusion restraint, tribal behavior and health grants. Again, a lot of these programs, there may be other things, you know, related to those programs that they're still doing. And they may find that these programs are duplicative or no longer needed. They don't provide a lot of rationale in the document, even though it's 400 pages. There's a lot going into this document, and not in every case do they explain the justification for why they think they want to remove some of these programs. But this is again a starting point for what they think programs they think should be eliminated. But there are a bunch that they think they should be either modified or eliminated. But not all the information's in the justification at this time. So if they will go forward, I'm sure they would get a lot more questions about what exactly they want to get rid of and why they want to get rid of those programs.
All right. And in the meantime, what's happening? Are things moving or stagnant or people don't know? Or
so I think we're a little bit of a limbo period right now. I do think, though, that they want to move forward with AHA. They want to move forward with other types of restructuring. The first step in that process was reducing staff. Because again, they think there are duplicative functions within the HHS, and that process has begun. Again, they've hit some roadblocks, legal roadblocks with that. And also there are bringing people back on where there have been gaps, but that's been, the starting point. You know, I do not know. And I wish I did know when they would move forward with the AHA, the big transition in the administration of Healthy America, and whether or not they were waiting for Congress to do it or whether they could make some changes on their own. Now, interestingly, there was a Congressional Research Service, a CRS. I know we're kind of in nerdy, policy land here, but this Congressional Research Service report about what HHS can do without Congress and what they need to do with Congress. And their response was, it really depends. For example, were HRSA and SAMHSA be technically eliminated, or were they be just still technically on the books, HRSA and SAMHSA, but under the umbrella of Administration for Healthy America? And so words matter, how they structured matters, and I'm sure we're going to get more details as they go forward. We have heard that, they are trying to figure out, who's going to be the head of Administration for Healthy America. In fact, the head of HRSA, the acting head of HRSA, and will be, I think, the first AHA administrator once that moves forward. So they're trying to get their organizational structure in place and their team in place. And so they do want to move forward on some pieces and get it up and running. But I think they're a little bit stuck at this point in time with the legal challenges, with other challenges, while waiting for Congress to act before they can really move forward with everything they want to do.
Understood. And specific grants like naloxone, opioid treatments, harm reduction, drug prevention programs, that has not stopped?
That has not stopped. So right now, all those programs have not stopped. Now, I think when this administration came in, some of the grants at NIH and other grants were paused. As they got their new leadership team into place and understood how the money flowed, and the NIH director and others within the administration have been very vocal in terms of that they want to get that money flowing. The secretary also said that existing programs on the books that have been appropriated by Congress will be continuing on, will go on. He has said in multiple occasions that Congress appropriates the dollars and we'll spend, being HHS, what Congress appropriates. Now, there have been some criticism, which you're alluding to, Dr. Lev, about some of the funding slowing down or not receiving funding that they've already been it's already been appropriated, it's already been promised to different parties. And again, I think that what this comes down to is that the administration, when they came in with the DOGE and with other kind of efforts they put in place to really kind of crack down on where is the spending going, how is it being spent, they have slowed down that spending. That has happened. But I think what we've been told, at least, is that they want to they're now going to continue the funding on. So they've been evaluating, figuring out where the funding has where the funding is going, and that has slowed down the funding. But that funding will be turned back on. And so again, it's been a slower than liked among different stakeholders in terms of, you know, where is this funding that, you know, we had a contract, we had a grant, where is that funding? And it has slowed down, but I think we've been told at least it will be turned back on.
Interesting. I do see that, like, Office of Tobacco. I was just kind of like trying to scroll through these 400 pages. Office of Tobacco.
Yeah, I know. It's a lot to look through. And they're very detailed programs as well. And again, even because there's so many programs that will be implemented, they don't provide a ton of explanation on each individual one. It would be instead of a 400-page document, it would be a 10,000-page document. So that's the problem there, yeah.
Yeah, interesting. All right, I have to go through that because, see, I know that there's a marijuana office. I don't know if that one's being cut as well.
So you have to kind of pick your poison in terms of searching for exactly the program you want to find and whether or not that's going to be modified or continued on or proposed for elimination. But again, I think it is a little bit of a moving target. And I want to really reiterate that this is a plan, where they want to go, not necessarily where they may wind up for various reasons. But and that happens in every single president's budget as well. When they put forward the request to Congress, Congress does not always approve that request in totality. Sometimes they don't approve any of the requests, which is someone who worked on the budget for 8 years was annoying. You worked very hard on a budget document and Congress may not accept any of it after.
And then what happens?
You know, the recent years, what Congress has done is provide a continuing resolution, or what they call a CR. And that just continues funding from the previous year on to the next year. And in that respect, that could continue programs that should be retired. And also, some programs need more funding, some programs need less funding over time. That's how things operate. And by providing the same level of funding year in and year out, that leads to inefficiencies, and that leads to, unfortunately, a government where we don't really want it to operate. Where again, they're required to fund programs at the same levels as previous years, even if they may need more or less funding.
Interesting. Now, when you're talking about all these cuts and restructuring and budget, does that involve the medical reimbursement and healthcare coverage?
Yeah, that's a great question. So right now, the changes that I was talking about really impact, and this is getting a little bit into the budget weeds here, but funding for the different parts of HHS, most of it is what we call discretionary funding. Discretionary funding is subject to appropriation. So a Congress has appropriations committees. They evaluate the different requests from HHS and other departments across the federal government, and they fund these agencies to run programs. So these are the people that actually run day-to-day Medicare, Medicaid, other programs. Like the CMS has its own discretionary budget called CMS Program Management Dollars. It's about a $4 billion appropriation. They're requesting in this budget a $3.5 billion, about a $500-600 million cut for efficiencies. But it's been around $4 billion. And that's to run Medicare and Medicaid. That's not actually the amount that goes to pay the physicians. That's to run the day-to-day programs. The actual reimbursement for physicians, funding for Medicare, funding for Medicaid, funding for the actual the plans and benefits, that's called what we call mandatory funding, not discretionary funding, but mandatory funding, because that's actually mandated and not subject to congressional approval year in, year out. The major mandatory funding like Medicare and Medicaid are also called entitlement programs, meaning that they that whatever is spent for these programs for Medicare and Medicaid in terms of benefit dollars, those are actually not subject to any kind of congressional limitations in terms of for Medicare specifically. So what, if a Medicare beneficiary sees a physician, that physician should be paid. Now, how the physician is paid at what level, that's a separate process that's done through rulemaking. Every year, CMS publishes multiple rules, regulations, which I go through with a fine-tooth comb, and I describe in my regs and next blog, updating payment rates for physicians, updating payment rates for hospitals for different programs. That's a separate process from the budget process, but it's done through regulations every year. And actually coming up is the Medicare Physician Fee Schedule proposed rule and outpatient prospective payment proposed rule that sets payments for physicians for 2026 and also for outpatient hospital services. So major regulations, which are thousands of pages long, which I, again, I read, that update payment rates for hospitals, for physicians. And now, to make matters even more complicated, Congress at the same time right now is considering a separate exercise called reconciliation. They are to extend the tax cuts that were put into place under Trump, the first administration, under Trump's first administration. But they're also looking at reforms to Medicaid programs. There was talk about also reforms to how physicians are paid under Medicare. In fact, I can go on for this for hours. This is a topic that that I find near and dear to my heart, being, you know, working at ACEP and having actually a brother and parents who are physicians. But physicians are have not their payments under the Medicare physician fee schedule have not kept up with inflation. And there's been discussions about how to modify physician payments. There was a reform suggested in the House bill that actually passed the House of Representatives. The Senate right now does not have that in their reconciliation bill. And so we're seeing whether or not that will be added back. But if the Senate winds up passing a bill without a what we call a doc fix, then you know it would not go anywhere because it has to be both the House and the Senate to get passed and signed into law. So right now it's not in the Senate version. But there has been discussions, Dr. Lev, about reforming the physician payment under Medicare because it, in many people's views, it's a broken system. The payment rates have not kept up with inflation. They've actually been, the last 5 years have been cuts. Can you believe it? Cuts to physician payments with all the increases in practice costs and other expenses, with inflation being pretty high and the cost of running a practice, you know, increasing every year. The amount of money that had been paid for Medicare services for physicians has decreased the last 5 years. So it is, in many people's view, a broken payment system that needs to be fixed. Congress are looking at different options, but right now it's looking like it would not be addressed if the Senate does not add it back into their version.
I think people listening may think, well, you know, doctors make a lot of money, so what's the big deal? And I think, you know, I've had it as a doctor perspective and knowing what we get paid for, like $35 to intubate someone and save someone's life. Like, I think, you know, people pay more for their haircut. But I think the public doesn't differentiate the crazy bills. And I've received that as a patient, that they get for their regular coverage, and understand that the doctor part of that is really a small sliver. Like if I got my doctor bill, I'm thinking, okay, that's great. You know, I pay more again to my plumber than for my doctor. But then you see the whole hospital bill, and that is like, you know, what? That was $80,000 for one day in the hospital. Like,
there are and physicians. I think it's really important for patients to understand that they get multiple bills from hospitals, from different providers who provide that care during a care episode. It's a complicated billing structure we have in place right now, where you get multiple bills for the same episode of care, and that does cause confusion. I think conversations about how the healthcare system could be fixed, we could go on forever about that. But yeah, that's just one of the issues facing, and it's confusing the patients getting multiple bills as well.
But you're talking about, okay, a fix of reconciliation to get, you know, inflation fix for physician payment. But yet we're also hearing that physicians, I think there's a protest scheduled June 30th to walk, work less for 4 to 10 minutes in protest for the cuts of Medicare. How is that discrepancy?
So I think there's a couple of things going on in this reconciliation bill. So there have been the Medicare payment update. We want to get a payment update that's tied to inflation. And I can go into that a little bit, but I think there's also been discussions about Medicaid cuts, and a lot of physicians, emergency physicians as well, see a lot of Medicaid patients, and these Medicaid cuts that they're describing, it's more nuanced than that. I could go on for a little while about the reforms that the House and the Senate are contemplating in terms of Medicaid. How they're being explained is a lot of them address some of the address fraud, waste, and abuse and other parts of Medicaid, making sure the people who are really entitled to Medicaid remain on it. Other people who don't necessarily, immigration status or other types of individuals would not no longer have Medicaid. So there are a bunch of changes that are being contemplated. This is a little bit in flux right now because as we're speaking, and I think things will change, but there's a little bit up in there in terms of what will actually get past the Senate. And sign into law. So some of this could be changing, but the Congressional Budget Office has projected that perhaps payment rates for physicians would be cut under Medicaid if states have to save money through some of these reforms, or people who are currently on Medicaid will lose coverage. So they have made those projections right now. Again, Congressional Budget Office that scores and reviews all legislation is this projection of what happens, and they're guessing what will happen if these modifications are being made. But I think that's what you're referring to, Dr. Lev, is that there are major changes to Medicaid being contemplated. Again, we're not sure what's going to cross the finish line, but in that respect, I think physicians are a little bit nervous that if states have less money for Medicaid, will they have to make changes to reimbursement rates for physicians? What are providers going to get paid under Medicaid? Because Medicaid rates are even lower than Medicare rates. And if that's squeezed even more, then what would that look like? I think there's a little bit of uncertainty right now about what those changes would be.
How does that affect people with a substance use disorder who need care?
Yeah, a lot of them are on the Medicaid program. And depending on what changes are made to who's eligible for Medicaid, there are one of the big changes, for example, that they're contemplating is the fact that there are work requirements imposed for Medicaid. You have to, through those work requirements, not really work, it's really community engagement. You have to show that you are engaged in a work or community activity certain amount of time. And you have to, in order to be eligible for Medicaid, you have to show the state government that you are, again, engaged in those activities. There is, if through that way you don't, even if you have a job or you're looking for one, but you don't report to the state government, or in some way you don't, or you don't have a job and you don't meet those requirements anymore. Either way, if you don't report or if you don't have one, you could lose your Medicaid coverage. So that could impact people with substance abuse disorders or other disorders, or just across the board, who don't meet that work requirements, if they're actually put into place and go through. So that's the kind of like the some of the changes that could impact overall Medicaid beneficiary enrollees.
So it could affect like who gets enrolled, right?
If you're eligible for Medicaid
status, and the eligibility part that's contentious is now. Is requiring work and not covering illegal.
Correct. Right. And in terms of work requirements, I wouldn't say there. This is an area where I think there's some agreement about implementing work requirements. I think the question is how do you prove and how often you have to prove that you have these work requirements, and also there are exceptions built into the law as well. So.
Right.
Except different exceptions and where these exceptions ultimately be, that's another issue. I think that right now, I want to be very clear, this is a Republican exercise, reconciliation. So Democrats have not engaged in this, and this is reconciliations can't get through with 50 votes without having in the Senate, without having to engage the other party. So right now, some of these conversations are just happening on the Republican side. But there have been discussions about, you know, exactly what the work requirements and other requirements within the Medicaid, what the Medicaid changes would do, who would lose their insurance, how hard would it be to maintain insurance. All those conversations are still going on. But a lot of it, Dr. Lev, again, are just estimates from the Congressional Budget Office, from researchers about what that potential impact would be if these policies were going in place. I obviously we don't know exactly what would happen if that went through. Yeah.
And the other thing that affects patients would be prices of medications, coverage for rehab, those sides of things. Are they being touched?
You know, not directly. But again, the issue is if states are, again, have to do more with less or be able to figure out exactly how to continue the Medicaid programs with less federal funding, what services would they need to cut? I think that's the question that each individual state is going to have to make if these reductions in spending go through and states are forced to think about, okay, I was covering this service or that service before. Can I still cover that? Do I need to make any changes to what my coverage options are?
All right. So, but in general, the changes, what's making patients, providers, and grant programs nervous, or what? Why should they not be nervous?
You know, I think right now, overarchingly, I think right now we're a little bit of, like I was saying, a flux period where, you know, I think what made people nervous was the fact that even funding that had been promised by the federal government. Through NIH or other grant programs were put on hold temporarily, and they want to make sure that they receive that federal funding. And they're nervous about getting the dollars that have already been appropriated. They are they have read through some of these changes that they're proposing in this restructuring. They read through that list that I referred to earlier of programs that they want to eliminate or modify. One of those programs may be something that they are invested in, and if they're on the chopping block, so to speak, they would be nervous about that. So right now, I think we're in a limbo period where we're uncertain about the current dollars, how the current dollars are being allocated. Are they going to get all their money through the grants? Because again, that's slowed down a little bit. And then what's going to happen in the future? If we go forward with the restructuring and some of the programs that they want to reduce or eliminate go forward and are eliminated, and one of those programs is something that they have been tied to, how is that going to be impacted? Another thing is, even the program continues, will they have new leadership in place? Will there be a new way of getting new funding requests approved? Will there be a new order of operations, so to speak? And where existing program, even if it's still going forward, but because it's housed under a different part of HHS, the Mission for Healthy America, or another part of HHS, Will that change in any way the underlying program, who runs it, how you get funding? So again, we're in a little bit of a flux period right now, a change where we're kind of waiting to see how all this will shake out.
All right, interesting. All right, so that's for the grants. For patients, I think, you know, probably status quo unless your whole coverage is threatened.
Yes. And there are changes to being contemplated to the ACA exchanges, the marketplace, the Obamacare exchanges, in terms of eligibility and also when you can enroll in those plans and how you can enroll in those plans, and the Medicaid changes that are being contemplated as well. So a little bit of uncertainty in terms of what category you fall in. Could you lose your coverage? Could any changes that the state makes to accommodate all those other changes impact you in any other way? So again, a little bit of a flux period. And some of these changes will not be implemented right away. They may be implemented over time. So a lot's said to be done. A very interesting time in healthcare where we are kind of in a wait and see mode at this point in time, where some changes are being made now, but most of them are going to be made at a later date, depending on, again, what Congress ultimately does with this big beautiful bill that's in the reconciliation bill, and what happens with the budget as well.
Interesting. So, Jeff, you obviously like all the weeds and intricacies of things. All these changes, while you know a lot of people are nervous, does this Does this make you happy? You like it? It's like, let me follow more things.
You know, it makes things, it keeps you on your toes as someone who's in the space. And these, you know, again, president's budgets request changes. Every administration wants to make their own stamp on policy, wants to make changes to how things operate under their department. I think it's safe to say that these are significant changes that this administration wants to make in terms of the restructuring, in terms of how they want to reorganize things. I think being bold comes with, you know, people, a lot of pushback, as you were mentioning, Dr. Lev, with either Congress or other stakeholders nervous about change. So that could impede or at least slow down how the secretary and how this administration goes about making those changes. So, you know, trying to give advice to people is, you know, is a little bit challenging at this point in time with all these kind of, you know, with the roadblocks, with, you know, needing Congress to act, with the legal challenges, with kind of understanding what HHS can do on its own versus needs to wait for Congress, versus what's already happened, what will happen. I think it makes it challenging, to be honest, to provide, you know, really good to be a sage and tell people exactly what's going to happen, because I don't know exactly what's going to happen. Yeah. It keeps me on my toes. It definitely keeps me on my toes. But, you know, what I will say, though, is some of the underlying processes that that as a regulatory person, I've come to rely on, such as what I referred to earlier, the Medicare payment rules, some of the big regulations that come out every year. Those are still coming out. Those are still going through what we call normal order. They're still seeking comment about a lot of deregulation ideas, about how to make changes, which administrations typically do when they're new. They seek comment on, through request for information, on ways of making reforms, what changes need to be made. So in that respect, you know, that is the normal order in terms of the regulatory process still continuing going forward. So I think that I can provide a little bit more certainty to our clients on, in terms of, yes, there will be regulations. Yes, there will be updates to Medicare payment rates for different types of facilities, for physicians, just like there are year to year. But the overall structure of HHS could look different. And also with the reduction in staff that they've announced, how will that impact day-to-day operations? You know, some of those questions, we still don't know the answers to.
Right. But I think for most doctors and patients and non-big activists, it's just, you know, let the dust settle. And
yes,
it's probably going to work out.
Yes. I think, you know, I think we need to see where the chips, you know, fall, see how this all settles out. And I think really, you know, understanding, you know, what the secretary is, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, he's a big job. He needs to have he has a vision for where he wants to bring the department. And, you know, every secretary, every administration has their vision. And we need to be able to understand, without, you know, coming to judgment before we even know what the final plan is going to actually look like, what the impacts will be. Because we don't know what the impacts will be overarchingly until we know exactly what, you know, they put forward the requests. They put forward their requests for how they want funding, what they want to be eliminated. But that, again, I'm repeating myself, but that might not be what actually happens. So I think we have to wait to see what actually happens before jumping to conclusions of what the overall impacts will be.
Yeah, that's great. Jeff Davis, thank you so much for your advice, explanation. You know, you could look at their website. I tried to do my background preparing for this, but you gave a really nice explanation. And it's good to see you again. Thank you for
It's good to see you. Thank you so much for having me on.
Eggs and regs, if anybody wants the geeky stuff.
Yeah, yeah, I know. If anyone wants to dive into regulations, regs and eggs, eat your eggs with regs every Thursday morning.
Thank you. Thank you, Jeff.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to Drug Free America Foundation. Visit DFAF.org. And ISAC, the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis. That's IASIC1.org. High Truth producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.